Let's see. So, welcome back to reality of our English service. We took a little break last week, right? If you weren't here, let me explain what I mean by that. Last week we had a different setup, right? Where we had, because we're in the second chapter of the throne room scene in Revelation, we actually had kind of a different setup to illustrate this last week. So when Daniel was preaching last week, we had a literal, well, not literal, but we had a throne made out of these chairs that all of us were sitting in the middle of the room. We had four living creatures who actually sang the holy, holy, holy part, right? And walked around. And then we were facing each other, and everything in the room was facing the throne that you see in the previous chapter, the one before we read. And Daniel had some fun with it because we're facing everyone like this way. If people came in after all the songs were done, he could totally kind of roast them and like point them out for being late. And then because they were all confused of where to sit, because you kind of had to sit on that side or walk right past, I guess, the throne of God, right, to try to find a seat. But no one wants to do that. So they tried to sit on this side and then it got filled up, right? And so, but it was such a cool setup, and a lot of you really liked it, so maybe we'll try it again at some point. We're not doing it today. We've kind of come back to our normal setup, but we are still in the throne room scene in the book of Revelation. Our series that we're in is called Gospel from Beginning to End. We looked at the start of God's relationship with his people in the book of Genesis, the first book of the Bible, and now we're reading through the last book of the Bible, and we're calling this part of the series Gospel Endings, which is we're going through the book of Revelation. So this is part two of the throne room scene in the book. All right, so I've got a couple of photos that help us illustrate. So Daniel showed us this thing called the Brick Testament. It's where they like reenacted scenes in the Bible, like using Legos, right? So this was a picture of kind of the throne room scene. You've got the throne room here in the center, and the being sitting on it, which we believe is God from the text. We've got the four living creatures. It's a pretty creative picture using Legos. I loved playing with Legos as a kid, but I don't love this one because it's like, I don't know, God looks a little small, right? Like that's probably not the best way we want to portray it, but it at least gives us a visual. So I was poking around and I think I found a better, more accurate picture of last week's chapter. This is a little bit better, right? Yeah, so here's the throne room, or this whole thing is the throne room, but here's the throne. What the Brick Testament failed to do was, in verse 3 of chapter 4, there's a very clear description of the amount of, like, kind of radiance and colors of the one who's sitting on the throne, right? And you get to see that a little bit better. You've got the four living creatures, the 24 elders, and everything is centered around the throne in the middle, and the one who is sitting on the throne is God. And so last week, with the different setup of the chairs that we had, I hope the symbolism was not lost on us, that when we really worship God, putting God in the center of everything, like that's the way it looks here. And if he is the creator, which we talked about last week, the one with ultimate authority on this earth, then we should worship him and put him in the center. Now, it's one thing to do that in like the way we set up the chairs, but then when we think about putting God in the center of our lives, that was something that we talked about at length last week. And when we can fix our eyes on God and put him in the center, like I guarantee our lives are infinitely better, right? And so we saw that if the colors in this photo, if they represent his glory and honor and majesty and all the parts of who God is, because he created this whole earth, and he, the one sitting here, the center of all worship, here in the throne room, like that is such an important thing. And when we fix our eyes on him, we put him in the center, then our lives are much, much better. And so there's a phrase that I shared this with you like 4 years ago, like when we were preaching just a topical message in the book of Revelation, and I asked you to repeat something because we have a hard time remembering this in our lives. So repeat after me, and we're going to hopefully see how this plays out in the passage. But God is God, and I am not. You've heard me say that, or ask you to say that many times over the past several years. But in our lives, week to week, day by day, moment by moment, everything that we go through, we lose sight of that really easily, right? And so I loved the setup that Daniel had come up with last week, where we had the throne room right in the middle. Because I know I lose sight of that. I know we lose sight of that. And when we put God in the center, we're putting him in the proper place as the creator, right? If chapter 4 is about worshiping the creator, the chapter we just read, it's about worshiping the redeemer. And what this is important to show us is some of us can get behind the idea that God created all things, that there is this all-powerful being. But just God as a creative being is not enough for us as individuals. And what I mean by that is we need more than just a creator, but we need a redeemer as well. Because it helps us see that God is more than just an impersonal God who made everything, but he also redeems us so that we might better know him and connect with him. And that's what we see in chapter 5. The second half of the throne room is really important because it gives us personal answers to very important questions for us in our lives. Hopefully we're going to see that in the passage. So let's take a look at verse 1 that we read. And if that picture was a description of the throne room and God being worshipped as the creator, we saw some singing in chapter 4. We're going to see some more here in chapter 5. But let's get into what we see here. Then I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with 7 seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, "Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll?" Can we go back one slide to that picture? So this red thing here, I think it says Holy Bible, so now I'm questioning my choice of image. But in the text, in chapter 4, the being sitting on the throne is holding this scroll. And so if we go back to the verses, when John observes is because this being who's sitting on the throne, who's all-powerful, is holding this scroll, John really wants it to be opened, right? And the angel asks, who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll? So one question for us to actually understand what's going on, we need to know, what is this scroll? What is this even talking about? We can see that it's important because it's got 7 seals, right? If you ship something, UPS, and it's like, you know, very, like, it's like breakable, you might package it very carefully, right? And then if you want to make sure the recipient gets it, you have to have them do the signature, right, to confirm that they've received it. If there are 7 seals on this scroll, there's got to be some, like, level of importance to it, right? And we can see that. Now, in order to understand what this actually is, we're going to cheat a little bit and read ahead to chapter 10. And the reason for this is in chapter 10, it actually helps us understand what this scroll is. And it'll help us see going on here in this section. And the seals that we're going to see in coming chapters, not today, but in future chapters in Revelation, the things that will take place on earth when the scroll is opened. But if we could go to the next slide. In chapter 10, we get at least a little bit of an answer of what this scroll is that this being who is sitting on the throne is holding, right? It says, but in the days when the 7th angel is about to sound his trumpet, the mystery of God will be accomplished, just as he announced to his servants, the prophets. So by this point, we'll get there when we get a few chapters later, but we're going to see all the 7 seals have been opened. And when the scroll, it's not quite open, but when it's about to be opened, we see it's explained, the mystery of God will be accomplished. And so the best guess that we can make to what this scroll is, it's the mystery of God. Now, that might sound a little bit vague yet important, and the next verses in chapter 5 of John's perspective help us see just how important this is for us. So let's read on in verse 3 and 4. But no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. I wept and wept because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or look inside. And if we're saying the scroll is the mystery of God, then John's reaction to this, I actually believe it's the same as ours. And hopefully this makes sense as we talk about it. But I think we have the same reaction to what is happening, the same reaction that John has here in this section. And this is where, if Revelation is an apocalyptic and confusing book of the Bible, I hope we can see, in the ways that we actually understand this more than we might think, This is where Revelation, this apocalyptic book with all these images and visions that might not be the simplest thing to understand, is actually so important for us today. Because we understand John's reaction in verse 3. Why do we understand this? John observes that no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll. There's no one. So the being sitting on this throne, Jason waves at me as he walks in. I love it. Yeah. He's holding the scroll, right? Maybe he wasn't waving at me. I don't know. And he realizes that no one can open this on earth, and it makes him so sad, right? And if the scroll represents the mystery of God, there are things that happen in our lives that have no human answers that make us really, really sad. And our reaction is the same as John, where it's like we see something on the news or we think about something in our personal lives where we are like, God, I don't see the answer for this. And we don't see the answer. And that makes us sad. We're the same as John, where he weeps and he weeps because he thinks no one can actually unlock this mystery of God, the deep things of God that we actually have lots of questions about, right? This is not any, like, this could not be more relevant than this week. And the reason for that is because this week at Santa Fe High School in Texas, we saw, by some accounts, the 22nd school shooting of 2018. 22. The year's not even halfway over. We're not even into the sixth month of the year. And this is according to, and to say there's been 22 school shootings, what I mean by that is there have been at least 22 shootings where one person got shot on a school campus. And so by all accounts, that's what we have. If the numbers are skewed a little bit, if maybe it's slightly less than that, say it was 18, in our minds, that's still 18 too many. And we see it on the news, and we think about the fact that even in our schools, where many of us have either been, if we've gone to school our lives and now we're done with school, or many of you are still in school, and we think the place that I have to go to every day might not be safe. And that's the reality that we have to live in, right? And so we ask ourselves, like, why? Why does this happen? Or we think, what can be done to solve this problem? And there are so many discussions about tighter gun control or gun laws or background checks and all these things. And no matter what your thoughts on the matter are, no matter what suggestions you might have to make this world a safer place, one thing I think we can agree on is nothing to this point has stopped the problem of gun violence in our schools to this point. You have to at least concede that the issue is not fixed. People are literally dying on school campuses, and there is seemingly no answer to that, as best as we can tell. So the question of what can be done to change this has not been answered. There's no answer. And that has made people, especially in the Santa Fe community, or in Parkland, or in other places where this has taken place, it is a tragedy, right? And we don't have an answer for it. And so the reason why John is weeping when he thinks there is no one who's able to open this scroll, this mystery of God, that's because there is no human answer. Like, there are things that happen in this world, in the big picture, things we see on the news, that have no answer. Not that we've seen yet. Ray Stedman, one of the most famous preachers in the Bay Area back in the latter half of the 20th century. And when he was talking about this idea, he said, you could take even the best well-known president, say Abraham Lincoln, who's known for doing a lot of really great things, or you could take the faces on Mount Rushmore, and you could say, even with these great human leaders that we've had, it has not solved the violence and the tragedies that we experience in our country today. And that's true. And what that means is for these deep things that hurt us to our core, sometimes there is no earthly answer for it, right? And so the reason we understand verse 3 more than we might think is because that, much like the epidemic of gun violence that exists in our country, when we personalize the mystery of God, We know that there are things in our own lives as individuals that have no answer. We have asked God before, God, the thing that I'm facing in my relationships, in my family, with my friends, why is there no answer? We've been there before. And so that's why when we see these things on the news, we actually get a little bit outraged because we've experienced personally in different ways, maybe like just in much more personal ways, what we see in the tragedies that might be showing up on the news. So does that make sense that we actually know what John is saying when he sees that there's no, he observes that there's no one, that he thinks there's no one worthy to open the scroll, and it makes him really sad. And we go through things in our lives where there's seemingly no answer and there's pain and we don't understand it. We've been there before. That's why we can connect with the tragic nature of what we see, because there are no earthly answers to some of the difficult things that happen in our lives. We weep and we weep the same way verse 3 describes John, our author, because there are things that painfully have no human answer or solution in our lives. So whether it be the broken parts of our lives or the brokenness that we see at almost every turn that our world takes, we are sad because there's no human answer. And that is why what happens in this throne room, the throne room of God, that is why what we see next in the passage is such good news for us. Because if we're like John and we look at the brokenness in our own lives or on TV or in the lives of people around us that are very important to us and there's seemingly no answer, we need something, right? And hopefully, I hope that we can see what God is trying to communicate to us through his word as we read on in this throne room scene. This is why what happens next is such good news. If there are things in this life that have no human answer, there is an answer. And this is where we insert our Sunday school cliche that Jesus is always the answer. But hopefully, when we think about the depths of how sad the brokenness of humanity makes us feel, that this will have even more meaning. So let's read on in verse 5. Then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals." Verse 6. Then I saw a lamb looking as if it had been slain, standing at the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. And the lamb had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. And so one of the 24 elders is saying, you might think there's no one who's worthy to answer, to open the scroll. You might think there is no answer to the mystery of God or to the brokenness or the pain that we feel in our lives. But this elder who says, who comes to console John, he says, there is an answer. Let me show you who it is. Let's go back to the Brick Testament for a moment. Let's see. So here we go. One slight difference. We've got the four living creatures a little bit off to the side. And then here is the lamb with seven eyes, right? Now, again, like it gives us a good visual a little bit to start to imagine it, but the weakness, again, of the Brick Testament is what is this thing going to actually do, right? Like what power does this thing actually have? So, like here's a better image of this lamb with seven eyes. Right, now looks a little crazier, right? But it actually reminds us of the picture of Jesus we saw in Revelation chapter 1. The coloring is a little bit faint because of the contrast in this room, but if you looked at this on the computer screen, like this shadow part is red with blood because it's a lamb looking as if it was slain. So if we're trying to piece together what's happening here in the throne room of God, where God is sitting on the throne and someone needs to be able to open the scroll to unlock the mysteries of God, the deep questions of God, the things that we don't understand, who is worthy? And the elder is saying, this is who is worthy, right? Now, who is this lamb looking as if it has been slain? Now, the thing about sheep or lambs is we often think of them as harmless, kind of dumb. They need a shepherd to guide them. But I don't know about you. Some of you, your initial reaction to this thing was like, whoa, this thing, like, I don't want to mess with this thing, right? It's got some level of power to it, right? And the elder is saying, this is the one who's worthy to open the scroll. right? And so if there is no human answer to this idea that the scroll cannot be opened, who is this lamb that was slain that's worthy to do it? Who is this Lion of Judah? Now, you don't see any like immediate lion characteristics about this lamb looking as if it is slain, but it's got a certain level of like this stare from these seven eyes, like the thing means business, right? So it's like there is some like power like that you might associate with a lion, kind of the king of the jungle, the lord over all the beasts that exists in this lamb. And when you think about a mixture of those two characteristics, we sing songs like the very famous song, How Great Is Our God, you know, that Chris Tomlin sings. We hear it on the radio in the verse. We are praising the lion and the lamb. We are speaking of Jesus. Jesus, the one who has all the attributes of God, all the characteristics of God, he has this power, and yet he would lay down his life and be slain for us. And that's the one who's worthy to open the scroll. He is the answer for these deep questions that we have, this mystery of God that we see in the scroll. A lamb is often seen as meek and mild, and together this helps us understand the true lion and the lamb, Jesus Christ. And though he is God with the figurative power, maybe even more so, of a lion, he laid his life down on the cross so that we might be able to actually have answers to the similar questions that we have to John. And if chapter 4 was about God being the all-powerful creator, this is where we see this lion and the lamb being the redeemer of the brokenness that exists in this world, but maybe more personally, the brokenness that exists in our lives. And what I mean by that is when we search our hearts and our lives and we think about the ways we have fallen short, there are things that I know I have done in my life where there is no answer. Like, there's no defense. There's nothing that I can say that might make me actually measure up to the goodness and the glory of God. And I believe many of us have experienced that as well, where we can say, I've got nothing. There's no rationalization for the ways that I've fallen short. This is why in the song that we sing, that we've sung it many times, Lord, I need you. There's a line in there that says, you're my one defense, my righteousness. Oh God, how I need you. And we sing that because in our sin, in our brokenness, in the ways we cannot live the perfect life that we wish we could live, the righteous life that we would want to live, sometimes Jesus is the only answer. And when we can stop and we can admit, God, I am broken, I've got nothing, that's when we can say, only you, Jesus, are worthy of all these things because you've lived the perfect life and yet you laid down your life for ours. And that's the best answer that we're going to get to this mystery of God that we see in the scroll. And this is why as Christians, we get to experience the already but not yet fully established kingdom of God. When I think about the things in my own life that have no answer, when I know I have fallen short of the glory of God, this is why we need him so much, as the song suggests. Now, but what does that actually mean, though? Like, you know, if we break that down, it's like, practically speaking, do we actually receive something because there was a lamb who was worthy to open these scrolls, to actually unlock this mystery of God? Because if we say, like, the purpose of Revelation is just for us to look forward to when Jesus comes back one day, how does that help us right now, when we've seen the 22nd school shooting of 2018? How does that help us in our own lives where there are things that we know of that have no answer? What do we actually get? Like, we want something tangible or experiential, something we can point to say there is an actual answer for this. But if we can see that there are things in our lives that have no human answer, maybe we are looking for the answer in the wrong place. And if there is a battle that we see unfolding in the book of Revelation on the spiritual level, maybe we don't see an answer because we're looking for it in a human form when we need to see God does give us an answer. But it's not merely human. Jesus, yes, he came in the form of a human, but he is also God. And we need spiritual solutions in a world where there is no human answer, right? And so when we actually put God in the center, the way our room was set up last week, then we remember that he is God, that we are not. When we put him in the proper place of his power and authority, but also his redemption, which is on the throne and in the center, then there we can start to see where this answer comes from. And what God's word is teaching us is that when there is no human answer, there is still an answer. And it's good. And it's the only thing that we have. And for a lot of our world, this answer is not going to be satisfactory. But I think, I would hope, that many of us actually understand this idea as well. This week, if you were following the news during the school shooting, like, I'm sure many of us would be deeply affected, right? As we're seeing it, we're like, man, another one again? And we don't know how to make sense of it. We know there's no answers, as we've talked about. And when I remember when I was about to leave for college, because the UC started on the quarter system, most of my friends had already left for college. And so I was doing what I normally do in the morning, turning on the computer, logging into my favorite website, ESPN.com, right? And then I was like, wait, this is a sports website. How come there's nothing about sports on it? And this was on September 11th, 2001, right before I was about to go to college. And I remember seeing the images of the planes flying into the Twin Towers, right? And the aftermath of all that, the discussion that unfolded. And for that week, I remember thinking, gosh, like, how am I supposed to think about this? Like, what answer is there, right? And a bunch of my friends from the youth group that went to our church had a special prayer meeting at Leland. They were a year younger. So I went to that and we prayed. We just prayed. I don't even know what we prayed, but we prayed about things. And still, it felt a little bit unsettling. And then that night, that Friday night at youth group, Greg, this is back when Greg was in charge of the youth group, he had us just sit around in a circle and talk about how, like, this tragedy had affected us. Like, what did it make us think of, right? And that was the main thing that we did for the night, and a lot of us could express the different emotions that we might feel, or the different anger at certain things not being able to be controlled, like here on earth, right? And so the best part of that night, though, as we talked about it, it's not like we were going to come up with a perfect solution for all of the what went into what is known as one of the greatest tragedies in our recent history, right? But the part that I remember about that night that I will say was tangible and was real was when we stopped talking about it, and like it was really good to talk about it and share our thoughts, but when we were done talking about it, Greg had us all sing a bunch of worship songs. And at the beginning, I remember thinking, like, you know, is this the most appropriate time to do this, like in the midst of this tragedy? And what I found was as we kept singing, like, you know, generally youth group has a typical ending time, and we just kept singing, and we kept singing, and we just blew through that, and like parents were coming to pick people up, and we're still singing, because it was a way where we could cry out to the only one who has the answers in these moments, right? And now, that might not be a tangible solution for the violence that we see from an earthly perspective, but I can tell you that helped me understand both the brokenness of this world, but how I could carry on in that moment and actually remember, I cannot begin to understand why certain things happen. Only God knows that. But I know I can put him in the center of my life and he can give me the strength I need to carry on and face whatever brokenness is going on in that moment, right? And that's what we see happening in the second half of this chapter. Like, the stuff with the scroll, now that we've thought about that a little bit, the last 8 verses, it is about singing to God. Like, that's what we see in the text. So what that means then is this connection between having no human answer to unlock the mysteries of God, something to do with singing is actually part of that answer. And maybe it's not singing specifically. Maybe you're like, I'm not a musical person or whatever. But what these beings in the throne room are doing, they are worshiping God and they are putting him at the center. And that's the best thing that we can do when life has no answers, right? And we're going to see that in the last 8 verses of the chapter. Let's keep reading. He went and took the scroll from he took the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne. And when he had taken it, the 4 living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. Each one had a harp and they were holding golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of God's people. Verse 9. And they sang a new song, saying, "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, because you were slain. And with your blood you purchased for God persons from every tribe and language and people and nation. And you have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth." Now these beings who are worshiping, the 24 elders and the four living creatures, these are heavenly, in the throne room, these are people who have some level of authority and connection to the one who is ultimately on the throne, and they are bowing down in worship because the Lamb is worthy to open the scroll. That's what we see from these heavenly beings, right? Let's keep reading, verse 11. Then I looked and heard the voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands and 10,000 times 10,000. And they encircled the throne and the living creatures and the elders. And in a loud voice they were saying, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise." Verse 13. Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that is in them saying, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and honor and glory and power forever and ever." The four living creatures said, "Amen." And the elders fell down and worshiped. So who is now doing the singing? Thousands upon thousands of angels who are worshiping God because there is someone who is worthy to open the scrolls. And as best we can tell, this Lamb looking as it was slain, this is Jesus. And he is worthy of it. Because when it comes to the things that have no human answers in our lives, Jesus is the ultimate answer. He can give us that hope, hope that I could feel singing with my other youth group friends that night when we didn't know how to make sense of what we had seen on the news that night. And so there is some connection between the brokenness on earth where we're like, there's no answer for this. I don't know how to make sense of this. And worshiping God because of what Jesus has done. And so in chapter 4, we see we want to put God on the throne in the center because he's created us. But here's the thing, there isn't just this impersonal God who's up in heaven who doesn't come and engage with us in the moments of pain and the moments of brokenness, but he entered into this world and gave his life for ours, the Lamb, you know, looking as he's slain, he died on the cross and rose again for us so that we might know him, so that there is this heavenly being who wants to walk with us in the moments of our deepest brokenness. Where there are things where it's like, I don't know how to handle this. There's no answer for this. And God sent his son so that we would experience his presence. And that's a real thing. For many of us, I believe that's a real thing. And so we can say, there might not be earthly answers to the different things that come up in our lives. But we can point to the fact that God's presence is with us. And all we know is that God did something in the face of tragedy. He sent his son to enter into a broken world and be with us so he might understand what we experience. I don't know if we've ever experienced anything exactly like this where there's thousands upon thousands of angels who are singing. Maybe we've gone to a really giant concert at one time where there's like thousands and thousands of people, right? But one of the things that I love most about our church is singing praises to God has always been a big part of who we are. And maybe part of that reason is Greg, who was my youth group leader. The guy's still doing guitar lessons when he taught me how to play the guitar 20 years ago, right? And singing praises to God, like, has always been a big part of who we are as a church. When we have guest speakers come, one of the things they often say to us is like, wow, the congregation sings loud, and we're not a big church, right? And as we saw in all the letters and the ways that spoke to us, like, we've got all our own issues, right? We've got our own challenges. But one of the things I love the most about our church is that we sing passionately. And if we're following the flow of thought here in this throne room scene, there's actually something really important about singing passionate worship songs to God, because we are putting him on the throne and worshiping him for that, because he is the one who ultimately knows how to handle it, even when there is no earthly solution. So I have this last picture for us. This is an artist rendering of what the thousands upon thousands of angels could look like. Maybe we haven't experienced anything like this, but a lot of us have experienced this before. This is at our summer youth retreat, right? And we gather together with the other CCIC youth groups. And one of the things that people say is, when we gather together and sing praises to God, that's one of the most memorable parts of the thing. Now, if you were wanting to argue against just the truth of Christianity, and like you wanted to be very literal about this, you could say, like, what's so amazing about this? You've got 300 Chinese people singing at words on screens, and a couple of talented people are playing the music in front, right? But if you've been there, and if you've sung, or if you've been to something like this, you know, it made me think of the praise night that we did a couple years back that Enoch led, where we invited different churches to come and sing on a Sunday night, and the purpose was just to sing praises to God together. And I remember how impactful, how meaningful that was to many of us. Because if you have been in a situation like this, you know that there is something real as you are singing. You are not just singing words on a screen. It doesn't just depend on like the nice melodies or things that you hear from talented musicians who might be leading us in song. It's more than that. And I believe that's why we passionately sing to God, like here in our church on Sunday mornings. And so that is because when you know that Jesus is the one who's worthy, then you will praise him in the proper way. Now, for this morning, to illustrate this point, we're going to have some help. We have some guest singers who are about to come in. And so I want you to give them your best attention. We're going to listen to them sing a few praises musically, and then we'll sing one song all together at the end. All right? Now, they're pretty young. They might be a little freaked out. So do your best not to scare them. But they're going to come on in and sing a couple songs for us.